This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. John Grisham is a master storyteller whose best-selling thrillers take readers into the imagined underbelly of the legal world. And it's a realm he knows well. For nearly a decade, he was an attorney specializing in criminal defense and personal injury litigation. Also served as a state representative in the state of Mississippi. But in his latest novel, he steps away from the courtroom. Camino Island takes readers to the beach and puts the spotlight on the rare book trade. The novel also takes us to North Carolina, in particular a few hot spots along Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Camino Island is John Grisham's 30th book. The release marks his first tour of independent bookstores in 25 years. Going to be at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on Thursday, Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on June 27th, and joins us now, John Grisham. Welcome to the State of Things.
Happy to be here.
This is a departure from you in the sense that it is not a legal thriller. Tell us why you decided to write this book.
Well, the goal was to try to write an entire novel with no lawyers in it. and I almost made it. I got down to the very last chapter and finally kind of wrote myself in a corner and had to have a legal character or two, but they're not important characters and they don't last very long.
Rare books and bookstores do play an important part in this novel. Was this a sort of a conscious effort on your part to shine a light on that corner of the world?
Sure. I love bookstores and love rare books. And it was fun to create a plot involving a bookstore, great bookstore, in a fictional town on a fictional island in Florida. And the bookseller is a pretty cool guy. He's kind of a rogue, but he has a great bookstore. Makes a nice living out of his bookstore. Also makes a lot of money trading in rare first editions. And unknown to most people, he also makes a lot of money trading in stolen rare books. And that's what the story's all about.
Including and especially manuscripts of F. Scott Fitzgerald from the Princeton Firestone Library, right?
Correct.
And this was something that you had pretty well laid out. I mean, there's a little Ocean's 11 in here. We've got a very detailed sketch of exactly how the caper is going to be pulled off.
Yeah, the first chapter starts off with a bang as a team of professional thieves, art and manuscript and artifacts thieves pull the perfect heist and get the manuscripts. They use a diversionary tactic on campus one night, the active shooter, supposedly, and they pull it off perfectly, and they've done the crime, and they have the five Fitzgerald manuscripts.
Maybe I can ask you to read for us from early on in the book.
Okay. This is page 4, first chapter, and it's a little bit of background into F. Scott Fitzgerald and the manuscripts. F. Scott Fitzgerald enrolled in Princeton in the fall of 1913. At the age of 16, he was dreaming of writing the great American novel and had indeed begun working on an early version of This Side of Paradise. He dropped out 4 years later to join the Army and go to war, but it ended before he was deployed. His classic, The Great Gatsby, was published in 1925, but did not become popular until after his death. He struggled financially throughout his career, and by 1940 was working in Hollywood, cranking out bad screenplays, failing physically and creatively. On December 21, he died of a heart attack brought on by years of severe alcoholism. In 1950, Scotty, his daughter and only child, gave his original manuscripts, notes, and letters, his papers, to the Firestone Library at Princeton. His five novels were written on inexpensive paper that did not age well. The library quickly realized that it would be unwise to allow researchers to physically handle them. High-quality copies were made, and the originals were locked away in a secured basement vault where the light, air, and temperature were carefully controlled. Over the years, they had been removed only a handful of times.
Author John Grisham reading from his latest novel, Camino Island. John Grisham is going to talk about the book at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville on Thursday. And he's going to be at Greensboro at Scuppernong Books on June 27th. Now, had this been a fascination of yours for a while? I mean, Fitzgerald in general, are you a fan? That's sort of question one. But the other one is these manuscripts. Have they been sort of rattling about in your imagination for a while?
Not manuscripts. We started off, my wife and I started kicking this story around a couple of years ago, we were listening to NPR, taking our summer road trip to Florida. And there was some story about some stolen rare books. We can't remember what it was. And so it kind of piqued our curiosity. And I did some research and realized that rare books are really hard to pin down because they're all the same. If there's a printing of 5,000 hardback copies with the first run, they're all identical. But manuscripts are not, handwritten manuscripts. So we got away from rare books and started talking about stolen manuscripts. I collect first editions of Faulkner, Hemingway, Steinbeck, Fitzgerald, and a few others. And so I thought about those four. The Hemingway stuff is scattered. It's not in one place. The Steinbeck stuff is also, his manuscripts are here and there. In fact, the University of Virginia, where I live in Charlottesville, has the first draft of The Grapes of Wrath, sold to it years ago by one of Steinbeck's relatives who had taken possession. UVA also has almost the entire Faulkner collection, and I've actually seen that. It's in a vault, and it's protected. But there are so many of them. Faulkner wrote 35 books, and he's very meticulous about his first drafts, his manuscripts, and that left Fitzgerald, who only wrote 5 novels, a bunch of short stories, a bunch of other things, but only 5 novels, and they're all in one place, in the Firestone Library at Princeton. And so that's where I got the idea of creating this fictional heist that takes place there. I deliberately stayed away from Princeton. I've never been to the library, never seen it, don't know where the manuscripts are kept, did not ask anybody, did not want to be accurate because I don't want to inspire someone to get any crazy ideas. So that's how that came about.
And then you take us to Chapel Hill, a very special. You talked about living in Charlottesville, but in fact you do spend some time in North Carolina. Is that right?
We have a house on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. I spend a lot of time there. My wife is very involved with UNC. A lot of her, volunteer time, nonprofit time goes to various boards and committees at UNC. She's a Tar Heel. My daughter is a Tar Heel. My daughter married a Tar Heel, and a year ago she gave birth to one. So the grandchild lives in Raleigh. So with him around now, we spend even more time in Chapel Hill.
Ironically enough, your heroine, Mercer Mann, is a University of North Carolina Chapel Hill professor about to lose her job. Tell us more about her.
Well, she's not from Carolina. She's from Memphis, but she's a 31-year-old novelist who has a rather severe case of writer's block. Her first novel was published when she was 24 to great acclaim critically. Didn't sell much. Then she published a collection of stories, and those don't sell much either. And to survive, she's had several teaching gigs around the country. And when we meet her in the spring, springtime, she's finishing up her creative writing class at UNC. And because of budget cuts, she's being phased out. And she doesn't want to teach. She wants to be a writer. She wants to write full-time like all writers do. But many of them, are forced to have other jobs. And so she's down on her luck. She is failing creatively. She doesn't have an idea for the novel she's been working on for 5 years. It's not going to work. And she is approached by sort of a mysterious person she's never met before. The person's from Washington, and this person offers her a very attractive financial package to go to Florida, to this resort town, and to try to infiltrate this world where this bookseller has, they think he has the manuscripts. And she's very familiar with Camino Island, too.
Well, before we get to Florida, maybe you can take us to Chapel Hill, and I can ask you to read for us again.
All right, hang on one second. Let me find the page here. Mm-hmm. It's chapter 3, called The Recruit. On a perfect spring day in late April, Mercer Mann walked with some anxiety across the Chapel Hill campus of the University of North Carolina. She had agreed to meet a stranger for a quick lunch, but only because of the prospect of a job. Her current one, adjunct professor of freshman literature, would expire in 2 weeks, courtesy of budget cuts brought on by a state legislature dominated by those rabid about tax and spending cuts. She had lobbied hard for a new contract, but didn't get one. She would soon be out of work, still in debt, homeless, and out of print. She was 31 years old, quite single, and, well, her life was not exactly going as planned. The first email, one of two from the stranger, a Donna Watson, had arrived the day before and had been about as vague as an email could be. Ms. Watson claimed to be a consultant hired by a private academy to locate a new teacher of creative writing for high school seniors. She was in the area and could meet for coffee. The salary was in the range of $75,000 a year, on the high side, but the school's headmaster loved literature and was determined to hire a teacher who had actually published a novel or two.
That is John Grisham reading from his latest novel, Camino Island. In about another paragraph, we end up at Spanky's on Franklin Street for people familiar with Chapel Hill. He's going to be at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro on June 27th, and before that, Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville this Thursday, reading from the novel. So she finally does. She takes it. Now, she's getting $100,000 to do this, plus they're going to pay off her student loans, right? So this is a pretty good deal. Even though she's not much of a detective, she takes the gig, right?
Yeah, she really has to. I mean, the money's too good. She's broke, and she gets to go live at the beach for 6 months, and it's a beach that she knows very well because she spent a lot of time there as a kid on Camino Island, and that's why they picked her. They did a perfect job of selecting her. They found her. This company did to pay and to infiltrate.
Infiltrate. Supposedly. She meets Bruce Cable, the owner of the independent bookstore on Camino Island. Tell us more about Bruce.
Well, Bruce bought the bookstore when he was 23 years old. He's had it for 20 years, and he's a great bookseller, sells a ton of books, knows everybody in publishing, knows a lot of writers. They visit his store. He reads three or four books a week. He loves books, publishing, authors, the whole publishing scene. You know, he's in his store 7 days a week. Each day he wears a different colored seersucker suit with dirty bucks, no socks, white starched shirt with a bow tie, has long hair that's turning gray. He's a very, very handsome guy, and I guess like all booksellers. I've caught a lot of grief from my bookseller buddies who want to be Bruce. And he's kind of a playboy. He loves the money. He's a good business guy. Also loves women, and they find him very attractive too. And it's a perfect match because as the young authors come through on the book tours, they're usually alone, and the female ones know Bruce, and he knows them. So that's always in the background.
That's always in the background. This particular match works, and mayhem ensues. We won't give away the ending. I won't take you too much more farther into this. But I do want to talk about the fact is you've also managed to sneak some advice to young writers in this book. I guess that answers their question, so they don't have to ask you at the reading tips for writers. You snuck a few of those in there, right?
Well, Bruce is a massive reader, and he has no patience with a book that doesn't work. And he's got too many other books to read. And so, you know, this argument plays out. Do you – my wife, when she starts a book, she's going to finish it even if she doesn't like it. And we've been having this discussion for almost 40 years. If I start a book and don't like it, I'll hang on to about page 50 and then fling it across the room. There are too many other books to read. And, you know, you probably have the same discussions with people. But there are some folks who are determined to finish, you know, a bad book. Yeah. And so Bruce is not like that. And he's talking to Mercer, and they're having this conversation. And so he starts giving not advice to her, but advice he would give to any aspiring writer about writing. And he's got his list of tips on how to write popular fiction. And a few of them are shared in the book, and those are also my tips.
They are your tips. We want to know that because we want to know, you know, should we bother to ask you at the reading, or can I just get the book?
And they're going to ask me anyway, okay?
That's good. Let me take a tangent here. You've mentioned your wife a couple of times. Does she read your stuff, and is she your first editor?
Oh, yeah. She actually signs off on the idea before I write the first word, and several ideas – you know, rattle around for a long time, and she may not like an idea, and I may, you know, work on it, change it, bring it back for another shot, and she may love an idea immediately, and so then I'll start writing the book. Usually, when I get about halfway finished with the manuscript, I'll shove it on her, and because I want to know, you know, is the story working? Does the opening grab you? Is there a hook? Is the tension there after 200 pages? The hardest part of writing a 400-page novel or a 500-page novel when you're writing suspense is not the hook, not the opening, and that could be, you know, usually something very dramatic, or the ending, which you hope is a surprise. The challenge is sustaining 300 pages in the middle and keeping the tension there, and that's not always easy. So she'll read the first half, and then as I get near the end, she'll read, you know, three or four chapters at a time. She doesn't really edit. She'll correct mistakes and things like that, but she's a great sounding board because she's not afraid to say anything.
So does she tell you, does she say, look, I lost my attention. I started drifting here, and then you fix it? Or does she offer suggestions?
Both. If the one thing I can't stand is if somebody says, somebody who I listen to, this book is dragging right here. That's just a red flag, and I'm going to, you know, I'm stop everything and fix it if I can. And that's where she's very, very valuable. She's like, this is kind of boring. You know, I wrote a book one time. I was 100 pages into the book and loved the story, thought it was brilliant. And I made her read the first 100 pages, and she said, I really don't like any of these people. And I said, okay, I'll show you. So I sent the book to my editor in New York. And he said, you know, I don't like any of these people. So, I put the book back on the shelf, and it never got written.
Glad you didn't say your wife left you for your publisher. Thank God it didn't end that way. It would have been, that would have been horrible. So, listen, you're on your first independent bookstore tour in 25 years. You're making four stops in North Carolina. You've already talked with some local authors. I know you talked to Jill McCorkle, Randall Keenan. You're going to be talking with Ron Nash, Wiley Cash, Clyde Edgerton. And you're having conversations. Tell us about those conversations. How are they going?
They're a whole lot of fun because I'll sign in these stores for the afternoon session, 4 or 5 hours, and sign a bunch of books. And around 5 o'clock, the crowd stays. We have a nice crowd. We had nice crowds in the bookstores. And for about an hour, hour and a half, I'll talk to the writers. They ask me questions. We have a discussion about writing, the process, reading, what do you enjoy? Publishing, what's your publishing history? How'd you get the first book published? You know, really fun stuff. And the crowd, people who are there, a lot of them dream of writing, and you know, they love to hear writers talk. There's also a lot of, so far we've had four of these, and there's been a lot of humor, you know, a lot of funny stuff. And we're recording all of them, and they're going to be podcast broadcasting. I think the first one is next Thursday night. So we're going to start releasing one a week throughout the summer.
That'll be great.
So, yeah, I think it's going to be interesting.
Ron Rash will think it's funny that I just called him Ron Nash. But anyway, that's Ron Rash up in Asheville. I'm talking with John Grisham, best-selling writer, best known for his legal thrillers, the new book Camino Island. Going to talk about that book at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville this Thursday. Then he's going to be in Greensboro at Scuppernong Books June 27th. John Grisham, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Just ahead, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo reads from his new collection of stories. Stay with us. Thank you.